It's been almost 10 years since I first ran for political office. I was 35 at the time, 4 years out of law school, recently married and generally impatient with life. A seat in the Illinois legislature had opened up, and several friends suggested that I run, thinking that my work as a civil rights lawyer and contacts from my days as a community organizer would make me a viable candidate. After discussing it with my wife, I entered the race and proceeded to do what every first-time candidate does. I talked to anyone who would listen. I went to block club meetings and church socials, beauty shops and barber shops. If two guys were standing on a corner, I would cross the street to hand them campaign literature. And everywhere I went, I'd get some version of the same two questions. Where'd you get that funny name? And then, you seem like a nice enough guy. Why do you want to go into something dirty and nasty like politics? In response, I would usually smile and nod and say that I understood the skepticism, but that there was, and always had been, another tradition to politics. A tradition that stretched from the days of the country's founding to the glories of the civil rights movement. A tradition based on the simple idea that we have a stake in each other, and that what binds us together is greater than what drives us apart. And that if enough people believe in the truth of that proposition and act on it, then we might not solve every problem, but we can get something meaningful done. When I decided to run for the United States Senate, I wasn't so sure of myself. By all appearances, my choice of career seemed to have worked out. After spending my first two terms laboring in the minority, Democrats had gained control of the state Senate, and I'd subsequently passed a slew of bills, from reforms of the Illinois death penalty system to an expansion of the state's health care program for kids. I'd continued to teach at the University of Chicago Law School, a job I enjoyed, and was frequently invited to speak around town. I'd preserved my independence, my good name, and my marriage, all of which, statistically speaking, had been placed at risk the moment I set foot in the state capitol. But the years had also taken their toll. Some of it was just a function of my getting older, I suppose. For if you're paying attention, each successive year will make you more intimately acquainted with all of your flaws. The blind spots, the recurring habits of thought that may be genetic or may be environmental, but that will almost certainly worsen with time, as surely as the hitch in your walk turns to a pain in your hip. In me, one of those flaws had proven to be a chronic restlessness, an inability to appreciate, no matter how well things were going, those blessings that were right there in front of me. It's a flaw that's endemic to modern life, I think. Endemic, too, in the American character. In any event, it was as a consequence of that restlessness that I decided to challenge a sitting Democratic incumbent for his congressional seat in the 2000 election cycle. It was an ill-considered race, and I lost badly, the sort of drubbing that awakens you to the fact that life is not obliged to work out as you'd planned. At some point, I arrived at an acceptance of my limits, and in a way, my mortality. I refocused on my work in the state Senate, and took satisfaction from the reforms and initiatives that my position afforded. I spent more time at home, and watched my daughters grow, and properly cherished my wife, and thought about my long-term financial obligations. I exercised and read novels, and came to appreciate how the earth rotated around the sun, and the seasons came and went, without any particular exertions on my part. And it was this acceptance, I think, that allowed me to come up with the thoroughly cockeyed idea of running for the United States Senate. An up-or-out strategy was how I described it to my wife. One last shot to test out my ideas before I settled into a calmer, more stable, and better-paying existence. And she, perhaps more out of pity than conviction, agreed to this one last race, though she also suggested that given the orderly life she preferred for our family, I shouldn't necessarily count on her vote. Freed from worry by low expectations, my credibility bolstered by several helpful endorsements, I threw myself into the race with an energy and joy that I thought I had lost. I hired four staffers, all of them smart, in their 20s or early 30s, and suitably cheap. We found a small office, printed letterhead, installed phone lines and several computers. 4 or 5 hours a day, I called major Democratic donors and tried to get my calls returned. I held press conferences, to which nobody came. We signed up for the annual St. Patrick's Day parade and were assigned the parade's very last slot, so that my 10 volunteers and I found ourselves marching just a few paces ahead of the city's sanitation trucks, waving to the few stragglers who remained on the route, while workers swept garbage and peeled green shamrock stickers off the lampposts. Mostly, though, I just traveled, often driving alone, first from ward to ward in Chicago, then from county to county and town to town, eventually up and down the state, across miles and miles of cornfields and bean fields and train tracks and silos. It wasn't an efficient process. Without the machinery of the state's Democratic Party organization, without any real mailing list or internet operation, I had to rely on friends or acquaintances to open up their houses to whomever might come, or to arrange for my visit to their church, union hall, bridge group, or rotary club. Sometimes, after several hours of driving, I would find just two or three people waiting for me around a kitchen table. I would have to assure the hosts that the turnout was fine and compliment them on the refreshments they'd prepared. Sometimes I would sit through a church service and the pastor would forget to recognize me, or the head of the local union would let me speak to his members just before announcing that the union had decided to endorse someone else. But whether I was meeting with two people or 50, whether I was in one of the well-shaded, stately homes of the North Shore, a walk-up apartment on the west side, or a farmhouse outside Bloomington, whether people were friendly, indifferent, or occasionally hostile, I tried my best to keep my mouth shut and hear what they had to say. I listened to people talk about their jobs, their businesses, the local school, their anger at Bush and their anger at Democrats, their dogs, their back pain, their war service, and the things they remembered from childhood. Some had well-developed theories to explain the loss of manufacturing jobs or the high cost of health care. Some recited what they'd heard on Rush Limbaugh or NPR. But most of them were too busy with work or their kids to pay much attention to politics, and they spoke instead of what they saw before them. A plant closed, a promotion, a high heating bill, a parent in a nursing home, a child's first step. No blinding insights emerged from these months of conversation. If anything, what struck me was just how modest people's hopes were, and how much of what they believed seemed to hold constant across race, region, religion, and class. Most of them thought that anybody willing to work should be able to find a job that paid a living wage. They figured that people shouldn't have to file for bankruptcy because they get sick. They believed that every child should have a genuinely good education, that it shouldn't just be a bunch of talk, and that those same children should be able to go to college, even if their parents weren't rich. They wanted to be safe, from criminals and from terrorists. They wanted clean air, clean water, and time with their kids. And when they got old, they wanted to be able to retire with some dignity and respect. That was about it. It wasn't much. And although they understood that how they did in life depended mostly on their own efforts, although they didn't expect government to solve all their problems, and certainly didn't like seeing their tax dollars wasted, they figured that government should help. I told them they were right. Government couldn't solve all their problems. But with a slight change in priorities, we could make sure every child had a decent shot at life and meet the challenges we faced as a nation. More often than not, folks would nod in agreement and ask how they could get involved. And by the time I was back on the road, with a map on the passenger seat, on my way to my next stop, I knew once again why I'd gone into politics. I felt like working harder than I'd ever worked in my life. This book grows directly out of those conversations on the campaign trail. Not only did my encounters with voters confirm the fundamental decency of the American people, they also reminded me that at the core of the American experience are a set of ideals that continue to stir our collective conscience, a common set of values that bind us together despite our differences, a running thread of hope that makes our improbable experiment in democracy work. These values and ideals find expression not just in the marble slabs of monuments or in the recitation of history books. They remain alive in the hearts and minds of most Americans and can inspire us to pride, duty, and sacrifice. You don't need a poll to know that the vast majority of Americans, Republican, Democrat, and Independent, are weary of the dead zone that politics has become, in which narrow interests vie for advantage and ideological minorities seek to impose their own versions of absolute truth. Whether we're from red states or blue states, we feel in our gut the lack of honesty, rigor, and common sense in our policy debates, and dislike what appears to be a continuous menu of false or cramped choices. Religious or secular, black, white, or brown, we sense correctly that the nation's most significant challenges are being ignored. And if we don't change course soon, we may be the first generation in a very long time that leaves behind a weaker and more fractured America than the one we inherited. Perhaps more than any other time in our recent history, we need a new kind of politics, one that can excavate and build upon those shared understandings that bind us together as Americans. That's the topic of this book, how we might begin the process of changing our politics and our civic life. This isn't to say that I know exactly how to do it. I don't. Although I discuss in each chapter a number of our most pressing policy challenges and suggest in broad strokes the path I believe we should follow, my treatment of the issues is often partial and incomplete. Instead, what I offer is something more modest, personal reflections on those values and ideals that have led me to public life, some thoughts on the ways that our current political discourse unnecessarily divides us, and my own best assessment, based on my experience as a senator and lawyer, husband and father, Christian and skeptic, of the ways we can ground our politics in the notion of a common good. I suspect that some listeners may find my presentation of these issues to be insufficiently balanced. To this accusation, I stand guilty as charged. I am a Democrat, after all. My views on most topics correspond more closely to the editorial pages of the New York Times than those of the Wall Street Journal. I am angry about policies that consistently favor the wealthy and powerful over average Americans, and insist that government has an important role in opening up opportunity to all. I believe in evolution, scientific inquiry, and global warming. I believe in free speech, whether politically correct or politically incorrect, and I'm suspicious of using government to impose anybody's religious beliefs, including my own, on non-believers. Furthermore, I'm a prisoner of my own biography. I can't help but view the American experience through the lens of a black man of mixed heritage, forever mindful of how generations of people who looked like me were subjugated and stigmatized, and the subtle and not so subtle ways that race and class continue to shape our lives. But that is not all that I am. I also think my party can be smug, detached, and dogmatic at times. I believe in the free market, competition, and entrepreneurship, and think no small number of government programs don't work as advertised. I wish the country had fewer lawyers and more engineers. I think America has more often been a force for good than for ill in the world. I carry few illusions about our enemies and revere the courage and competence of our military. I reject a politics that is based solely on racial identity, gender identity, sexual orientation, or victimhood generally. Undoubtedly, some of these views will get me in trouble. I am new enough on the national political scene that I serve as a blank screen on which people of vastly different political stripes project their own views. As such, I'm bound to disappoint some, if not all of them. Which perhaps indicates a second, more intimate theme to this book. Namely, how I, or anybody in public life, can avoid the pitfalls of fame, the hunger to please, the fear of loss, and thereby retain that kernel of truth, that singular voice within each of us that reminds us of our deepest commitments. Recently, one of the reporters covering Capitol Hill stopped me on the way to my office and mentioned that she had enjoyed reading my first book. "I wonder," she said, "if you can be that interesting in the next one you write." By which she meant, "I wonder if you can be honest now that you're a U.S. Senator." I wonder too sometimes. I hope writing this book helps me answer the question. Chapter 1. Republicans and Democrats. On most days I enter the Capitol through the basement. A small subway train carries me from the Hart office building, where my office is located, through an underground tunnel lined with the flags and seals of the 50 states. The train creaks to a halt, and I make my way, past bustling staffers, maintenance crews, and the occasional tour group, to the bank of old elevators that takes me to the second floor. Stepping off, I weave around the swarm of press that normally gathered there, say hello to the Capitol Police and Secret Service agents, and enter, through a stately set of double doors, onto the floor of the United States Senate. The Senate chamber is not the most beautiful space in the Capitol, but it is imposing nonetheless. The dun-colored walls are set off by panels of blue damask and columns of finely veined marble. Overhead, the ceiling forms a creamy white oval, with an American eagle etched in its center. Above the visitors' gallery, the busts of the nation's first 20 vice presidents sit in solemn repose. And in gentle steps, 100 mahogany desks rise up from the well of the Senate in 4 horseshoed rows. Some of these desks date back to 1819, and atop each desk is a tidy receptacle for inkwells and quills. Open the drawer of any desk, and you will find within the names of the senators who once used them. Taft and Long, Stennis and Kennedy, scratched or penned in the senator's own hand. Sometimes, standing there in the chamber, I can imagine Paul Douglas or Hubert Humphrey at one of these desks, urging yet again the adoption of civil rights legislation. Or Joe McCarthy, a few desks over, thumbing through lists, preparing to name names. Or LBJ, prowling the aisles, grabbing lapels and gathering votes. Sometimes I will wander over to the desk where Daniel Webster once sat and imagine him rising before the packed gallery and his colleagues, his eyes blazing as he thunderously defends the Union against the forces of secession. I remember January 4th, 2005, the day that I and a third of the Senate were sworn in as members of the 109th Congress, as a beautiful blur. The sun was bright, the air unseasonably warm. From Illinois, Hawaii, London, and Kenya, my friends and family crowded into the Senate Visitors Gallery to cheer as my new colleagues and I stood beside the marble dais and raised our right hands to take the oath of office. In the old Senate chamber, I joined my wife, Michelle, and our two daughters for a reenactment of the ceremony and picture-taking with Vice President Cheney. True to form, then 6-year-old Malia demurely shook the vice president's hand, while then 3-year-old Sasha decided instead to slap palms with the man before twirling around to wave for the cameras. A day of smiles and thanks, of decorum and pageantry. That's how it must have seemed to the Capitol's visitors. But if all of Washington was on its best behavior that day, collectively pausing to affirm the continuity of our democracy, there remained a certain static in the air, an awareness that the mood would not last. After the family and friends went home, after the receptions ended, and the sun slid behind winter's gray shroud, what would linger over the city was the certainty of a single, seemingly inalterable fact. The country was divided, and so Washington was divided, more divided politically than at any time since before World War II. Both the presidential election and various statistical measures appeared to bear out the conventional wisdom. Across the spectrum of issues, Americans disagreed. On Iraq, taxes, abortion, guns, the Ten Commandments, gay marriage, immigration, trade, education policy, environmental regulation, the size of government, and the role of the courts. Not only did we disagree, but we disagreed vehemently, with partisans on each side of the divide unrestrained in the vitriol they hurled at opponents. We disagreed on the scope of our disagreements, the nature of our disagreements, and the reasons for our disagreements. Everything was contestable, whether it was the cause of climate change or the fact of climate change, the size of the deficit, or the culprits to blame for the deficit. For me, none of this was entirely surprising. From a distance, I had followed the escalating ferocity of Washington's political battles, Iran-Contra and Ollie North, the Bork nomination and Willie Horton, Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, the Clinton election and the Gingrich Revolution, Whitewater and the Starr investigation, the government shutdown and impeachment, dangling chads and Bush versus Gore. With the rest of the public, I had watched campaign culture metastasize throughout the body politic as an entire industry of insult, both perpetual and somehow profitable, emerged to dominate cable television, talk radio, in the New York Times bestseller list. And for 8 years in the Illinois legislature, I'd gotten some taste of how the game had come to be played. By the time I arrived in Springfield in 1997, the Illinois Senate's Republican majority had adopted the same rules that Gingrich was then using to maintain absolute control of the U.S. House. Without the capacity to get even the most modest amendment debated, much less passed, Democrats would shout and holler and fulminate, and then stand by helplessly as Republicans passed large corporate tax breaks, stuck it to labor, or slashed social services. Over time, an implacable anger spread over the Democratic caucus, and my colleagues would carefully record every slight and abuse meted out by the GOP. 6 years later, Democrats took control, and Republicans fared no better. Some of the old veterans would wistfully recall the days when Republicans and Democrats met at night for dinner, hashing out compromise over a steak and cigar. But even among these old bulls, such fond memories rapidly dimmed the first time the other side's political operatives selected them as targets, flooding their districts with mail accusing them of malfeasance, corruption, incompetence, and moral turpitude. I don't claim to have been a passive bystander in all this. I understood politics as a full-contact sport and minded neither the sharp elbows nor the occasional blindside hit. But, occupying as I did an ironclad Democratic district, I was spared the worst of Republican invective. Occasionally, I would partner up with even my most conservative colleagues to work on a piece of legislation. And over a poker game or a beer, we might conclude that we had more in common than we publicly cared to admit. Which perhaps explains why, throughout my years in Springfield, I'd clung to the notion that politics could be different, and that the voters wanted something different, that they were tired of distortion, name-calling, and soundbite solutions to complicated problems, that if I could reach those voters directly, frame the issues as I felt them, explain the choices in as truthful a fashion as I knew how, then the people's instincts for fair play and common sense would bring them around. If enough of us took that risk, I thought, not only the country's politics, but the country's policies would change for the better. It was with that mindset that I entered the 2004 U.S. Senate race. For the duration of the campaign, I did my best to say what I thought, keep it clean, and focus on substance. When I won the Democratic primary and then the general election, both by sizable margins, it was tempting to believe that I had proven my point. No wonder, then, that upon my arrival in Washington that January, I felt like the rookie who shows up after the game, his uniform spotless, eager to play, even as his mud-splattered teammates tend to their wounds. While I had been busy with interviews and photo shoots full of high-minded ideas about the need for less partisanship and acrimony, Democrats had been beaten across the board, the presidency, Senate seats, House seats. My new Democratic colleagues could not have been more welcoming toward me. One of our few bright spots, they would call my victory. In the corridors, though, or during a lull in the action on the floor, they'd pull me aside and remind me of what typical Senate campaigns had come to look like. They told me about their fallen leader, Tom Daschle of South Dakota, who had seen more than $10 million worth of negative ads rain down on his head, full-page newspaper ads and television spots informing his neighbors day after day that he supported baby killing and men in wedding gowns, a few even suggesting that he'd treated his first wife badly despite the fact that she had traveled to South Dakota to help him get reelected. They recalled Max Cleland, the former Georgia incumbent, a triple amputee war veteran who had lost his seat in the previous cycle after being accused of insufficient patriotism, of aiding and abetting Osama bin Laden. 2 days after the election, President Bush appeared before cameras and declared that he had political capital to spare, and he intended to use it. That same day, conservative activist Grover Norquist, unconstrained by the decorum of public office, observed, in connection with the Democrat situation, that, quote, "Any farmer will tell you that certain animals run around and are unpleasant, but when they've been fixed, then they are happy and sedate." 2 days after my swearing-in, Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones, out of Cleveland, stood up in the House of Representatives to challenge the certification of Ohio electors, citing the litany of voting irregularities that had taken place in the state on Election Day. Rank-and-file Republicans scowled, sore losers, I could hear a few mutter, But Speaker Hastert and Majority Leader DeLay sat stone-faced from the heights of the dais, placid in the knowledge that they had both the votes and the gavel. Senator Barbara Boxer of California agreed to sign the challenge, and when we returned to the Senate, I found myself casting my first vote, along with 73 of the 74 others voting that day, to install George W. Bush for a second term as President of the United States. I would get my first big batch of phone calls and negative mail after this vote. I called back some of my disgruntled Democratic supporters, assuring them that yes, I was familiar with the problems in Ohio, and yes, I thought an investigation was in order, but yes, I still believed George Bush had won the election, and no, as far as I could tell, I didn't think I'd either sold out or been co-opted after a mere 2 days on the job. My wife will tell you that by nature I'm not somebody who gets real worked up about things. When I see Ann Coulter or Sean Hannity baying across the television screen, I find it hard to take them seriously. I assume that they must be saying what they do primarily to make money, although I do wonder who would spend their precious evenings with such sourpusses. When Democrats rush up to me at events and insist that we live in the worst of political times, that a creeping fascism is closing its grip around our throats, I may mention the internment of Japanese Americans under FDR, the alien and sedition laws under Adams, or 100 years of lynching under several dozen administrations as having been possibly worse, and suggest we all take a deep breath. When people at dinner parties ask me how I can possibly operate in the current political environment, with all the negative campaigning and personal attacks, I may mention Nelson Mandela, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, or some guy in a Chinese or Egyptian prison somewhere. In truth, being called names is not such a bad deal. Still, I am not immune to distress. And like most Americans, I find it hard to shake the feeling these days that our democracy has gone seriously awry. It's not simply that a gap exists between our professed ideals as a nation and the reality we witness every day. In one form or another, that gap has existed since America's birth. Wars have been fought, laws passed, systems reformed, unions organized, and protests staged to bring promise and practice into closer alignment. No, what's troubling is the gap between the magnitude of our challenges and the smallness of our politics. The ease with which we are distracted by the petty and trivial, our chronic avoidance of tough decisions, our seeming inability to build a working consensus to tackle any big problem. We know that global competition, not to mention any genuine commitment to the values of equal opportunity and upward mobility, requires us to revamp our education system from top to bottom, replenish our teaching corps, buckle down on math and science instruction, and rescue inner-city kids from illiteracy. And yet our debate on education seems stuck between those who want to dismantle the public school system and those who would defend an indefensible status quo, between those who say money makes no difference in education and those who want more money without any demonstration that it will be put to good use. We know that our healthcare system is broken, wildly expensive, terribly inefficient, and poorly adapted to an economy no longer built on lifetime employment. A system that exposes hardworking Americans to chronic insecurity and possible destitution. We know that the battle against terrorism is at once an armed struggle and a contest of ideas, that our long-term security depends on both judicious projection of military power and increased cooperation with other nations, and that addressing the problems of global poverty and failed states is vital to our nation's interests, rather than just a matter of charity. But follow most of our foreign policy debates, and you might believe that we have only two choices, belligerence or isolationism. We think of faith as a source of comfort and understanding, but find our expressions of faith sowing division. We believe ourselves to be a tolerant people, even as racial, religious, and cultural tensions roil the landscape. And instead of resolving these tensions or mediating these conflicts, our politics fans them, exploits them, and drives us further apart. Privately, those of us in government will acknowledge this gap between the politics we have and the politics we need. Certainly Democrats aren't happy with the current situation, since for the moment at least they're on the losing side, dominated by Republicans who, thanks to winner-take-all elections, control every branch of government, and feel no need to compromise. Thoughtful Republicans shouldn't be too sanguine, though, for if the Democrats have had trouble winning, it appears that the Republicans, having won elections on the basis of pledges that often defy reality, tax cuts without service cuts, privatization of Social Security with no change in benefits, war without sacrifice, cannot govern. And yet publicly, it's difficult to find much soul-searching or introspection on either side of the divide, or even the slightest admission of responsibility for the gridlock. What we hear instead, not only in campaigns, but in editorial pages, on bookstands, or in the ever-expanding blog universe, are deflections of criticism and assignments of blame. Of course, there is another story to be told, by the millions of Americans who are going about their business every day. They're on the job or looking for work, starting businesses, helping their kids with their homework, and struggling with high gas bills, insufficient health insurance, and a pension that some bankruptcy court somewhere has rendered unenforceable. They are by turns hopeful and frightened about the future. Their lives are full of contradictions and ambiguities. And because politics seems to speak so little to what they're going through, because they understand that politics today is a business and not a mission, and what passes for debate is little more than spectacle, they turn inward, away from the noise and rage and endless chatter. A government that truly represents these Americans, that truly serves these Americans, will require a different kind of politics. That politics will need to reflect our lives as they are actually lived. It won't be prepackaged, ready to pull off the shelf. It will have to be constructed from the best of our traditions, and we'll have to account for the darker aspects of our past. We will need to understand just how we got to this place, this land of warring factions and tribal hatreds. And we'll need to remind ourselves, despite all our differences, just how much we share. Common hopes, common dreams, a bond that will not break. There's no denying that American politics in the post-World War II years was far less ideological, and the meaning of party affiliation far more amorphous than it is today. The Democratic coalition that controlled Congress through most of those years was an amalgam of Northern liberals like Hubert Humphrey, conservative Democrats like Jim Eastland, and whatever loyalists the big city machines cared to elevate. What held this coalition together was the economic populism of the New Deal, a vision of fair wages and benefits, patronage in public works, and an ever-expanding standard of living. Throughout the 50s and early 60s, the GOP, too, tolerated all sorts of philosophical fissures. Between the Western libertarianism of Barry Goldwater and the Eastern paternalism of Nelson Rockefeller. Between those who recalled the republicanism of Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt with its embrace of federal activism, and those who followed the conservatism of Edmund Burke with its preference of tradition to social experimentation. It was the 60s that upended these political alignments for reasons and in ways that have been well chronicled. First, the civil rights movement arrived, a movement that even in its early, halcyon days, fundamentally challenged the existing social structure and forced Americans to choose sides. Then came the social protests against the Vietnam War, and the suggestion that America was not always right, our actions not always justified, that a new generation would not pay any price or bear any burden that its elders might dictate. And then, with the walls of the status quo breached, every form of outsider came streaming through the gates. Feminists, Hispanics, hippies, Panthers, welfare moms, gays, all asserting their rights, all insisting on recognition, all demanding a seat at the table and a piece of the pie. I've always felt a curious relationship to the 60s. In a sense, I'm a pure product of that era. As the child of a mixed marriage, my life would not have been possible, my opportunities entirely foreclosed, without the social upheavals that were then taking place. But I was too young at the time to fully grasp the nature of those changes, too removed, living as I did in Hawaii and Indonesia, to see the fallout on America's psyche. Much of what I absorbed from the 60s was filtered through my mother, who to the end of her life would proudly proclaim herself an unreconstructed liberal. The civil rights movement in particular inspired her reverence. Whenever the opportunity presented itself, she would drill into me the values that she saw there. Tolerance, equality, standing up for the disadvantaged. It was only as I got older then, during the 70s, that I came to appreciate the degree to which, for those who had experienced more directly some of the 60s seminal events, things must have seemed to be spinning out of control. Partly I understood this through the grumblings of my maternal grandparents, longtime Democrats who would admit that they'd voted for Nixon in 1968, an act of betrayal that my mother would never let them live down. Mainly, my understanding of the 60s came as a result of my own investigations, as my adolescent rebellion sought justification in the political and cultural changes that by then had already begun to ebb. In my teens, I became fascinated with the Dionysian, up-for-grabs quality of the era, and through books, film, and music, I soaked in a vision of the 60s very different from the one my mother talked about. Images of Huey Newton, the 68 Convention, the Saigon Airlift, and the Stones at Altamont. If I had no immediate reasons to pursue revolution, I decided nevertheless that in style and in attitude, I too could be a rebel, unconstrained by the received wisdom of the over-30s crowd. Eventually, my rejection of authority spilled into self-indulgence and self-destructiveness, and by the time I enrolled in college, I'd begun to see how any challenge to convention harbored within it the possibility of its own excesses and its own orthodoxy. I started to re-examine my assumptions and recall the values that my mother and grandparents had taught me. In this slow, fitful process of sorting out what I believed, I began silently registering the point in dorm room conversations when my college friends and I stopped thinking and slipped into cant, the point at which the denunciations of capitalism or American imperialism came too easily, and the freedom from the constraints of monogamy or religion were proclaimed without fully understanding the value of such constraints, and the role of victim was too readily embraced as a means of shedding responsibility or asserting entitlement or claiming moral superiority over those not so victimized. All of which may explain why, as disturbed as I might have been by Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, as unconvinced as I might have been by his John Wayne, Father Knows Best pose, his policy by anecdote, and his gratuitous assaults on the poor, I understood his appeal. It was the same appeal that the military bases back in Hawaii had always held for me as a young boy, with their tidy streets and well-oiled machinery, the crisp uniforms and crisper salutes. It was related to the pleasure I still get from watching a well-played baseball game, or my wife gets from watching reruns of The Dick Van Dyke Show. Reagan spoke to America's longing for order, our need to believe that we are not simply subject to blind, impersonal forces, but can shape our individual and collective destinies, so long as we rediscover the traditional virtues of hard work, patriotism, personal responsibility, optimism, and faith. That Reagan's message found such a receptive audience spoke not only to his skills as a communicator, it also spoke to the failures of liberal government, during a period of economic stagnation, to give middle-class voters any sense that it was fighting for them. For the fact was that government at every level had become too cavalier about spending taxpayer money. Too often, bureaucracies were oblivious to the cost of their mandates. A lot of liberal rhetoric did seem to value rights and entitlements over duties and responsibilities. Reagan may have exaggerated the sins of the welfare state, and certainly liberals were right to complain that his domestic policies tilted heavily towards economic elites, with corporate raiders making tidy profits throughout the 80s, while unions were busted and the incomes for the average working stiff flatlined. Nevertheless, by promising to side with those who worked hard, obeyed the law, cared for their families, and loved their country, Reagan offered Americans a sense of common purpose that liberals no longer could muster. And the more his critics carped, the more those critics played into the role he'd written for them, a band of out-of-touch, tax-and-spend, blame-America-first, politically correct elites. What I find remarkable is not that the political formula developed by Reagan worked at the time, but just how durable the narrative that he helped promote has proven to be. Despite a 40-year remove, the tumult of the 60s and the subsequent backlash continues to drive our political discourse. Partly it underscores how deeply felt the conflicts of the 60s must have been for the men and women who came of age at that time, and the degree to which the arguments of the era were understood not simply as political disputes, but as individual choices that define personal identity and moral standing. I suppose it also highlights the fact that the flashpoint issues of the 60s were never fully resolved. And maybe it just has to do with the sheer size of the boomer generation, a demographic force that exerts the same gravitational pull in politics that it exerts on everything else, from the market for Viagra to the number of cup holders automakers put in their cars. Whatever the explanation, after Reagan, the lines between Republican and Democrat, liberal and conservative, would be drawn in more sharply ideological terms. This was true, of course, for the hot-button issues of affirmative action, crime, welfare, abortion, and school prayer, all of which were extensions of earlier battles. But it was also now true for every other issue, large or small, domestic or foreign, all of which were reduced to a menu of either or, for or against, soundbite-ready choices. No longer was economic policy a matter of weighing trade-offs between competing goals of productivity and distributional justice, of growing the pie and slicing the pie. You were either for tax cuts or for tax hikes, small government or big government. No longer was environmental policy a matter of balancing sound stewardship of our natural resources with the demands of a modern economy. You either supported unchecked development, drilling, strip mining, and the like, or you supported stifling bureaucracy and red tape that choked off growth. In politics, if not in policy, simplicity was a virtue. For a younger generation of conservative operatives that would soon rise to power, for Newt Gingrich and Karl Rove and Grover Norquist and Ralph Reed, the fiery rhetoric was more than a matter of campaign strategy. They were true believers who meant what they said, whether it was no new taxes or we are a Christian nation. In fact, with their rigid doctrines, slash and burn style, an exaggerated sense of having been aggrieved, this new conservative leadership was eerily reminiscent of some of the new left's leaders during the 60s. As with their left-wing counterparts, this new vanguard of the right viewed politics as a contest not between competing policy visions, but between good and evil. You had to choose sides. It was Bill Clinton's singular contribution that he tried to transcend this ideological deadlock, recognizing not only that what had come to be meant by the labels of conservative or liberal played to Republican advantage, but that the categories were inadequate to address the problems we faced. In the first 2 years of his presidency, he would be forced to abandon some core elements of his platform, universal health care, aggressive investment in education and training, that might have more decisively reversed the long-term trends that were undermining the position of working families in the new economy. Still, he instinctively understood the falseness of the choices being presented to the American people. He saw that government spending and regulation could, if properly designed, serve as vital ingredients and not inhibitors to economic growth, and how markets and fiscal discipline could help promote social justice. He recognized that not only societal responsibility, but personal responsibility was needed to combat poverty. In his platform, if not always in his day-to-day politics, Clinton's third way went beyond splitting the difference. It tapped into the pragmatic, non-ideological attitude of the majority of Americans. Indeed, by the end of his presidency, Clinton's policies, recognizably progressive if modest in their goals, enjoyed broad public support. Politically, he had wrung out of the Democratic Party some of the excesses that had kept it from winning elections. That he failed, despite a booming economy, to translate popular policies into anything resembling a governing coalition, said something about the demographic difficulties Democrats were facing, in particular, the shift in population growth to an increasingly solid Republican South, and the structural advantages the Republicans enjoyed in the Senate. but that failure also testified to the skill with which Gingrich, Rove, Norquist, and the like were able to consolidate and institutionalize the conservative movement. They tapped the unlimited resources of corporate sponsors and wealthy donors to create a network of think tanks and media outlets. They brought state-of-the-art technology to the task of mobilizing their base and centralized power in the House of Representatives in order to enhance party discipline. And they understood the threat Clinton posed to their vision of a long-term conservative majority, which helps explain the vehemence with which they went after him. With enough repetition, a looseness with the facts, and the ultimately undeniable evidence of the president's own personal lapses, Clinton could be made to embody the very traits of 60s liberalism that had helped spur the conservative movement in the first place. Clinton may have fought that movement to a draw, but the movement would come out stronger for it, and in George W. Bush's first term, that movement would take over the United States government. This telling of the story is too neat, I know. It ignores critical strands in the historical narrative, how the decline of manufacturing and Reagan's firing of the air traffic controllers critically wounded America's labor movement, the way that the creation of majority-minority congressional districts in the South simultaneously assured more black representatives and reduced Democratic seats in that region, the lack of cooperation that Clinton received from congressional Democrats who had grown fat and complacent and didn't realize the fight they were in. It also doesn't capture the degree to which advances in political gerrymandering polarized the Congress, or how efficiently money and negative television ads have poisoned the atmosphere. Still, in the back and forth between Clinton and Gingrich, and in the elections of 2000 and 2004, I sometimes felt as if the psychodrama of the baby boom generation was being reenacted, a tale rooted in old grudges and revenge plots hatched on a handful of college campuses long ago. The victories that the 60s generation brought about, the admission of minorities and women into full citizenship, the strengthening of individual liberties, and the healthy willingness to question authority, have made America a far better place for all its citizens. But what has been lost in the process, and has yet to be replaced, are those shared assumptions, that quality of trust and fellow feeling, that bind us together as Americans. So where does that leave us? Theoretically, the Republican Party might have produced its own Clinton, a center-right leader who built on Clinton's fiscal conservatism while moving more aggressively to revamp a creaky federal bureaucracy and experimenting with market or faith-based solutions to social policy. And in fact, such a leader may still emerge. Not all Republican elected officials subscribe to the tenets of today's movement conservatives. In both the House and the Senate, and in state capitals across the country, there are those who cling to more traditional conservative virtues of temperance and restraint, men and women who recognize that piling up debt to finance tax cuts for the wealthy is irresponsible, that deficit reduction can't take place on the backs of the poor, that the separation of church and state protects the church as well as the state, that conservation and conservatism don't have to conflict, and that foreign policy should be based on facts and not wishful thinking. But these Republicans are not the ones who've driven the debate over the past 6 years. Instead of the compassionate conservatism that George Bush promised in his 2000 campaign, what has characterized the ideological core of today's GOP is not conservatism, but absolutism. There's the absolutism of the free market, an ideology of no taxes, no regulation, no safety net, indeed no government beyond what's required to protect private property and provide for the national defense. There's the religious absolutism of the Christian right, a movement that gained traction on the undeniably difficult issue of abortion, but which soon flowered into something much broader, a movement that insists not only that Christianity is America's dominant faith, but that a particular fundamentalist brand of that faith should drive public policy, overriding any alternative source of understanding, whether the writings of liberal theologians, the findings of the National Academy of Sciences, or the words of Thomas Jefferson. Of course, there are those within the Democratic Party who tend towards similar zealotry, But those that do have never come close to possessing the power of a rove or delay, the power to take over the party, fill it with loyalists, and enshrine some of their more radical ideas into law. The prevalence of regional, ethnic, and economic differences within the party, the electoral map and the structure of the Senate, the need to raise money from economic elites to finance elections, all of these things tend to prevent those in office from straying too far from the center. In fact, I know very few elected Democrats who neatly fit the liberal caricature. The last I checked, John Kerry believes in maintaining the superiority of the U.S. military, Hillary Clinton believes in the virtues of capitalism, and just about every member of the Congressional Black Caucus believes Jesus Christ died for his or her sins. Instead, we Democrats are just, well, confused. There are those who still champion the old-time religion, defending every New Deal and Great Society program from Republican encroachment, achieving ratings of 100% from the AFL-CIO, NARAL, the Sierra Club, and the NAACP. But these efforts seem exhausted, a constant game of defense, bereft of the energy and new ideas needed to address the changing circumstances of globalization or a stubbornly isolated inner city. Others pursue a more centrist approach, figuring that so long as they split the difference with conservative leadership, they must be acting reasonably, and failing to notice that with each passing year they are giving up more and more ground. Individually, Democratic legislators and candidates propose a host of sensible if incremental ideas on energy and education, healthcare and homeland security, hoping that it all adds up to something resembling a governing philosophy. Mainly, though, the Democratic Party has become the party of reaction. In reaction to a war that is ill-conceived, we become suspicious of all military action. In reaction to those who proclaim the market can cure all ills, we resist any efforts to use market principles to tackle pressing problems. In reaction to religious overreach, we equate tolerance with secularism and forfeit the moral language that would help infuse our policies with larger meaning. We lose elections and hope for the courts to foil Republican plans. We lose the courts and wait for a White House scandal. And increasingly, we feel the need to match the Republican right in stridency and hardball tactics. The accepted wisdom that drives many advocacy groups and Democratic activists these days goes something like this. The Republican Party has been able to consistently win elections not by expanding its base, but by vilifying Democrats, driving wedges into the electorate, energizing its right wing, and disciplining those who stray from the party line. If the Democrats ever want to get back into power, then they will have to take up the same approach. I understand the frustration of Democratic activists. The ability of Republicans to repeatedly win on the basis of polarizing campaigns is indeed impressive. I recognize the dangers of subtlety and nuance in the face of the conservative movement's passionate intensity. And in my mind, at least, there are a host of Bush administration policies that justify righteous indignation. Ultimately, though, I believe any attempt by Democrats to pursue a more sharply partisan and ideological strategy misapprehends the moment we're in. I'm convinced that whenever we exaggerate or demonize, oversimplify or overstate our case, we lose. Whenever we dumb down the political debate, we lose. For it's precisely the pursuit of ideological purity, the rigid orthodoxy and the sheer predictability of our current political debate that keeps us from finding new ways to meet the challenges we face as a country. It's such doctrinaire thinking and stark partisanship that has turned Americans off of politics. This is not a problem for the right, a polarized electorate, or one that easily dismisses both parties because of the nasty, dishonest tone of the debate, works perfectly well for those who seek to chip away at the very idea of government. After all, a cynical electorate is a self-centered electorate. But for those of us who believe that government has a role to play in promoting opportunity and prosperity for all Americans, a polarized electorate isn't good enough. Eking out a bare Democratic majority isn't good enough. What's needed is a broad majority of Americans, Democrats, Republicans, and independents of goodwill, who are re-engaged in the project of national renewal, and who see their own self-interest as inextricably linked to the interests of others. I'm under no illusion that the task of building such a working majority will be easy. Maybe the critics are right. Maybe there's no escaping our great political divide, an endless clash of armies, and any attempt to alter the rules of engagement are futile. Or maybe the trivialization of politics has reached a point of no return, so that most people see it as just one more diversion, a sport, with politicians our paunch-bellied gladiators, and those who bother to pay attention just fans on the sidelines. We paint our faces red or blue, and cheer our side, and boo their side, and if it takes a late hit or cheap shot to beat the other team, so be it, for winning is all that matters. But I don't think so. They are out there, I think to myself, those ordinary citizens who've grown up in the midst of all the political and cultural battles, but who found a way, in their own lives at least, to make peace with their neighbors, and themselves. I imagine the white Southerner, who growing up heard his dad talk about niggers this and niggers that, but has struck up a friendship with the black guys at the office, and is trying to teach his own son different. Who thinks discrimination is wrong but doesn't see how the son of a black doctor should get admitted into law school ahead of his son. Or the former Black Panther, who decided to go into real estate, bought a few buildings in the neighborhood, and is just as tired of the drug dealers in front of those buildings as he is of the bankers who won't give him a loan to expand his business. There is the middle-aged feminist who still mourns her abortion, and the Christian woman who paid for her teenager's abortion, and the millions of waitresses and temp secretaries and nurses' assistants and Walmart associates who hold their breath every single month in the hope that they'll have enough money to support the children that they did bring into the world. I imagine they are waiting for a politics with the maturity to balance idealism and realism, to distinguish between what can and cannot be compromised, to admit the possibility that the other side might sometimes have a point. They don't always understand the arguments between right and left, conservative and liberal, but they recognize the difference between dogma and common sense, responsibility and irresponsibility, between those things that last and those that are fleeting. They are out there, I think, waiting for Republicans and Democrats to catch up with them. Chapter 2. Values. The inside of the White House doesn't have the luminous quality that you might expect from TV or film. It seems well kept but worn, a big old house that one imagines might be a bit drafty on cold winter nights. Still, as I stood in the foyer and let my eyes wander down the corridors, it was impossible to forget the history that had been made there. JFK and Bobby Kennedy huddling over the Cuban Missile Crisis. FDR making last-minute changes to a radio address. Lincoln alone, pacing the halls and shouldering the weight of a nation. I was greeted immediately by a member of the White House legislative staff and led into the Gold Room, where most of the incoming House and Senate members had already gathered. At 1600 hours on the dot, President Bush was announced and walked to the podium, looking vigorous and fit, with that jaunty, determined walk that suggests he's on a schedule and wants to keep detours to a minimum. For 10 minutes or so, he spoke to the room, making a few jokes, calling for the country to come together, before inviting us to the other end of the White House for refreshments and a picture with him and the First Lady. I happened to be starving at that moment, so while most of the other legislators started lining up for their photographs, I headed for the buffet. As I munched on hors d'oeuvres and engaged in small talk with a handful of House members, I recalled my previous two encounters with the President, the first a brief congratulatory call after the election, the second a small White House breakfast with me and the other incoming senators. Both times I had found the President to be a likable man, shrewd and disciplined, but with the same straightforward manner that had helped him win two elections. You could easily imagine him owning the local car dealership down the street, coaching Little League, and grilling in his backyard, the kind of guy that would make for good company so long as the conversation revolved around sports and the kids. "Senator?" I looked up, shaken out of my memory, and saw one of the older black men who made up most of the White House wait staff standing next to me. "Want me to take that plate for you?" I nodded, trying to swallow a mouthful of chicken something or others, and noticed that the line to greet the president had evaporated. Wanting to thank my hosts, I headed toward the blue room. A young Marine at the door politely indicated that the photograph session was over and that the president needed to get to his next appointment. But before I could turn around to go, the president himself appeared in the doorway and waved me in. "Obama," the president said, shaking my hand. "Come here and meet Laura. Laura, you remember Obama. We saw him on TV during election night. Beautiful family. And that wife of yours, that's one impressive lady." "We both got better than we deserve, Mr. President," I said, shaking the First Lady's hand and hoping that I'd wiped any crumbs off my face. The President turned to an aide nearby, who squirted a big dollop of hand sanitizer in the President's hand. "Want some?" the President asked. "Good stuff. Keeps you from getting colds." Not wanting to seem unhygienic, I took a squirt. "Come over here for a second," he said, leading me off to one side of the room. "You know," he said quietly, "I hope you don't mind me giving you a piece of advice."
"Not at all, Mr. President."
He nodded.
"You've got a bright future," he said. "Very bright. But I've been in this town a while, and let me tell you, it can be tough. When you get a lot of attention, like you've been getting, people start gunning for you. And it won't necessarily be just coming from my side, you understand. From yours, too. Everybody will be waiting for you to slip. Know what I mean? So watch yourself."
"Thanks for the advice, Mr. President."
"All right. I gotta get along. You know, me and you got something in common."
"What's that?"
"We both had to debate Alan Keyes. That guy's a piece of work, isn't he?"
I laughed, and as we walked to the door, I told him a few stories from the campaign. It wasn't until he had left the room that I realized I had briefly put my arm over his shoulder as we talked, an unconscious habit of mine, but one that I suspected might have made many of my friends, not to mention the Secret Service agents in the room, more than a little uneasy. Since my arrival in the Senate, I've been a steady and occasionally fierce critic of Bush administration policies. So Democratic audiences are often surprised when I tell them that I don't consider George Bush a bad man, and I assume that he and members of his administration are trying to do what they think is best for the country. I say this not because I'm seduced by the proximity to power. I see my invitations to the White House for what they are, exercises in common political courtesy, and am mindful of how quickly the long knives can come out when the administration's agenda is threatened in any serious way. Moreover, when I write a letter to a family who's lost a loved one in Iraq, or read an email from a constituent who has dropped out of college because her student aid has been cut, I'm reminded that the actions of those in power have enormous consequences, a price that they themselves almost never have to pay. It is to say that after all the trappings of office, the titles, the staff, the security details are stripped away, I find the president and the men and women who surround him to be pretty much like everyone else, possessed of the same mix of virtues and vices, insecurities and long-buried injuries as the rest of us. No matter how wrong-headed I might consider their policies to be, and no matter how much I might insist that they be held accountable for the results of such policies, I still found it possible, in talking to these men, to understand their motives and to recognize in them values I shared. Outside of Washington, America feels less deeply divided. Illinois, for example, is no longer considered a bellwether state. For more than a decade now, it's become more and more Democratic, partly because of increased urbanization, partly because the social conservatism of today's GOP doesn't wear well in the land of Lincoln. But Illinois remains a microcosm of the country, a rough stew of north and south, east and west, urban and rural, black, white, and everything in between. Chicago may possess all the big city sophistication of L.A. or New York, but geographically and culturally, the southern end of Illinois is closer to Little Rock or Louisville, and large swaths of the state are considered, in modern political parlance, a deep shade of red. I first traveled through southern Illinois in 1997. It was the summer after my first term in the Illinois legislature, and Michelle and I were not yet parents. With session adjourned, no law school classes to teach, and Michelle busy with work of her own, I convinced my aide, Dan Shulman, to toss a map and some golf clubs in the car
and tool around the state for a week. Dan had been both a UPI reporter and field coordinator for several downstate campaigns, so he knew the territory pretty well. But as the date of our departure approached, it became apparent that he wasn't quite sure how I would be received in the counties we were planning to visit. Four times he reminded me how to pack. Just khakis and polo shirts, he said. No fancy linen trousers or silk shirts. I assured him that I didn't own any linens or silks. We stopped in a coffee shop to eat pie and swap jokes with the mayor of Chester.